Hello, and welcome to The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell, and today I'm coming to you from New Haven, Connecticut, Yale University. In 2012, Yale is doing its first Summer Writer's Workshop, and I'm here today with one of the instructors in that writer's workshop. His name is Mark Fitton.
Hi.
Welcome, Mark.
Hello. Thank you.
Mark is here from Atlanta, Georgia, where he makes his home. He's the author of a book called Valeria's Last Stand, a novel, which is set in Hungary. And I want to talk a little bit about that with you. Now, how did you grew up there?
I grew up in New York and in Atlanta.
Okay, so how does a guy who grew up in New York and Atlanta write a book set in Hungary? This book has been very, very popular in Europe, hasn't it?
Yes, it was very popular in Europe. And I traveled around a lot after high school and lived abroad for a number of years. And so when I got back to the States, I started writing the book. I had this idea that I thought would be fun, like the sweeping changes of Europe from the fall of the Berlin Wall until today. And I thought it would be neat to have a project that looked at a place that had been affected by that every decade or so. So that was the big sweep. And Valeria's Last Stand was the first book immediately after the Berlin Wall comes down. And then the book coming out in a few weeks is Elsa's Kitchen, which is 10 years on. So...
And is it also set in
Hungary?
In Hungary, okay.
And looking, you know, we're 10 years now from the fall of the wall, and in the new book we'll hear, or we'll read about how life kind of has changed at that point, up until that point.
I'm trying to conceive of what, a 19-year-old kid going around Europe. How long were you there? What were your living conditions? And how did you, in essence, research the novel?
Well, I researched, there's a term, what is it called? Participatory observation, I guess. And I went, I was young, I was silly, I didn't know any better, I didn't know anything about writing programs, I didn't know anything about anything. All I knew is that if you wanted to be a writer, you had to move to Europe. You had to go to Paris, and then, like, you would eventually write a novel. That's what I knew, that's, you know...
Worked for Hemingway.
I thought that's what you did. So, Paris, of course, is not... cheap, so I ended up in Eastern Europe and got an apartment, and I rented my apartment there. I had cash, a little bit of cash, and rent was $80 a month, so I could afford to rent it for 6 months, you know, up front. And at that point, I just stayed, and I worked illegally as an illegal immigrant in Eastern Europe, so I've had that experience. And I worked in bars, I worked teaching English, but it was mostly like as illegal labor.
It's a whole different notion to think of an American being an illegal immigrant.
That is correct.
In Eastern Europe. Well, we'd like to hear a little bit
okay.
of the book. Set us up and read some for us.
So I'm going to read maybe the opening page or two from Valeria's Last Stand. It's the first book. It's the book that is that's set after the wall has come down and the country is opening up for the first time. So we're introduced to the character Valeria. It's set in a village that has kind of been isolated, and there were little pockets that were very isolated from you know, just in terms of the fact that there weren't interstates that led to them, and they were just kind of off the beaten track. So it's a village like that, a very small village. And the thought was, what would happen to a small village like that when the floodgates opened? Valeria never whistled, nor did she approve of people who did. In 68 years, what Valeria had learned to be a truth about character was that people who whistled were crass. Whistlers were untrustworthy and irresponsible. They were shiftless. They were common. Butchers whistled.
peasants also. When they were supposed to be tending to their fields or completing any number of tasks peasants are meant to complete, Valeria was certain she could find them instead with their chins wet from a half liter of beer, sitting in the village's tavern, whistling at the slutty proprietress and telling off-color jokes. As for the butcher, he was the worst kind of whistler. He whistled right into his customers' faces, blew his fetid breath right into the nostrils of anyone who visited him. Certainly, a visit to the whistling butcher on Monday was a trip to the health clinic by midweek. Valeria thought about it while scrubbing the grout of her portico floor early in the morning. She was certain that the Queen of England did not whistle. The Hungarian president did not whistle either. She followed a line back through Soviet history. Trotsky may have whistled, Lenin certainly not. Stalin only whistled in madness. Subsequent leaders of the Soviet regime never whistled, not even Gorbachev. Yeltsin, Valeria's stomach turned when she thought about Russia's head of state. Yes, Yeltsin probably whistles, she decided. And prior to the communists or reformed communists or whatever they called themselves these days, the aristocracy they'd replaced had never whistled either. The Habsburgs certainly never had. Valeria scoffed just imagining it, a whistling Habsburg. She brushed away a stray leaf with the back of her hand. She remembered hearing the village's mayor whistle, and she swore.
Now, that's a wonderful start. I mean, we want to know more about Valeria right away. And I want to know more about how you created this woman. You said you came home.
Right. So the idea for the books came from a conversation I overheard while in Hungary between these two men. And it was, they were older. They were maybe in their 60s. They were gray-haired. And they were walking down the street talking to one another, and they were talking about the changes that had been happening. And the one looked to the other and said, it's like a golden age has passed and nobody cares. And that just struck me as being so odd, because we here in the States, we were so used to hearing that they just wanted the chance at a change in democracy, and that once they got that, everything would be great and they'd be really happy, people would be happy. And so that was completely counter to everything that I had ever thought of or considered. And that really got me wondering. And then I started paying attention to older people and started maybe doing the arithmetic and thinking, okay, so what happens when you're of a certain age, of an advanced age, and the world suddenly changes and all the rules and the context of your life is suddenly deemed incorrect and you have to start all over again? What do you do? How hard is that, and how do you survive? I mean, really, how do you survive? Because you can't go out and necessarily find work when you're past a meaningful work, maybe when you're past a certain age. So that's what got me started. That's what got me thinking. And I decided I'd write a book about an older woman, and so I just started with the fact that she didn't whistle, and that's where I thought said a lot about the character of the person, and not that just that she didn't whistle, but what she considered whistling. And so from that, I started to understand who my character was, so that's where she came from.
Valeria has a love affair.
Yes. Several love affairs. That's in the book. I wanted to write a book also about notions of elderly affection, elderly love, and she was alone for a long time, so I put that in there. Since everything is changing, why not let everything change?
Now, by my calculation, you would have been very young when you were writing this. Maybe early 20s?
I was in my 20s, yes.
How does a young man in his 20s know what's going on with an older woman in her 60s?
Wishful thinking, maybe. Projections of fantasy? I don't know, but a thought.
Did you talk to older people, or did you think about older people who've been in your life?
I am the kind of person who older people like to speak with. They just kind of come to and tell stories to. And that's something that's always been the case. And I like older people. And so when I started writing the book, had the idea that people are probably pretty much the same, you know, at 68 that they were at 28, and that spring affects everybody the same way. And if that's the case, then it seemed logical that a 68-year-old person would want to fall in love in springtime or something, just like a young person would. So I don't think we're people, have all the emotions still, and they have their, nothing changes, so why should it change? And that's kind of how it came.
Now, you said you left right after high school, but you did come back and get a degree.
Yes, I came back, got a degree.
And so, were you working on the degree and the book at the same time?
Oh, yeah, I was working on degrees, books, a young family, I did it all, a job at the same time. So it was, that's what I spent my 20s doing, getting established, doing all the things I had to do to become established. And that's, it was a lot of hard work. Really.
And no sleep,
right? But you can only do that, I guess, when you're young and energetic.
Was the book published in the United States or in Europe first?
Well, it was published, let me see if I remember this. It was certainly published in English first, Germany not long after, but it did seem to garner more interest in Europe first. So a German agent presented it to a German publisher, they liked it, and then an American agent came and he started to make deals for it around Europe and the UK. So my publisher is Bloomsbury, which is a British company, but Bloomsbury USA is the American arm of the company, and so when they purchased it for World English so that they could hit the international market and the United States.
Now, the book's been translated, though.
The book's been translated into 6 languages, yeah.
And languages that you don't speak?
Languages that I don't speak, no.
So how, as the author, do you deal with the fact that your words are being changed into... Because translations can make such a huge difference
right.
to a book.
Well, all the companies... You do it based on the reputation of the company that you're dealing with and based on the reputation of the translators. And all of the companies we dealt with were reputable companies. They were the Random Houses of their countries, so they provided the translator. They have a history of translating good books, so at that point you kind of throw your hands up, and when the translator has a question or wants to understand the meaning of an idiom that is like a cat house, I think in English I refer to a cat house, and I had to kind of explain what that meant, and then they can translated that way. So I certainly was contacted by translators for certain things, but for the most part I don't know the quality, really. I just assume based on the company and on the reputation that they would want to keep their reputation by doing a good job.
Was there any clenching of the stomach for you? I mean, did you describe this in such a businessman's kind of way, but it was your book. These are your words.
I'm pretty practically minded. I learned very early on that when you're writing the book, that's when the artist should be allowed to be himself and do what he needs to do. The moment you're done, I put on a different hat, and it's probably a more, businessman's way of looking at it, because what you realize early on is that no one is interested necessarily, who is involved in the business side of publishing, no one is really interested in what you think your literary illusions might be or things along that matter. They're thinking of how can we penetrate a market, and if they're thinking that, then it behooves me to think along the same lines in terms of moving the product. Not that I would refer to my work as a product while I'm working on it, but I understand that it's the place where art and commerce meet, and you have to figure out a way to negotiate that.
Let's talk a little bit about the process of producing the art. I'm always interested in finding out how writers do what they do.
Well, the first thing is the impulse. And the impulse, I don't know where the impulse comes from, and I don't know where my impulse comes from, but it exists. So I have the need to do this. Some people don't, but they do other things, like draw or, you know. So I have the need to create, and I have the need to create in prose. And so it starts there. When I'm working on a book or I'm working on a project, then I'm very actively involved in the book and the project. When I'm not working on a book or a project, then I'm not. So I'm not of the school that says, oh, you have to sit down and write 20 pages a day, because if I'm not working on anything, I'm not working on anything. But when I am working on something, then yes, I would probably sit down and write 2 pages a day and make it a goal and have a more systematic way of doing it. I look at creation very much like respiration, and so I look at it as there are moments when I'm inhaling and there are moments when I'm exhaling. And when I'm inhaling everything around me, all the images I can, and getting it all full in my creative sponge. And then when I'm writing, I make sure I squeeze the sponge and get all that stuff that's been in there out. And the thing about writing is that you are working even when you're not necessarily typing. You're still working because you're mulling things over and you're, well, should he do that? Should she do that? Should they do this? Why would they do this? What's the reason for doing this? So you're really thinking about your characters, and you're really thinking about the story and how you want to tell the story. And maybe if you, so I do that, and it's terrible because it's like a deep daydream. And I shouldn't drive, for example. It's really kind of I get pretty single-minded, so I get very dangerous. So,
catch yourself making mistakes.
Right, exactly.
Well, how long did it take to write the book?
It took most of my 20s. I started when I was 24, 25, and by the time I was 30. But I was doing so much other stuff. I was finishing school and working, and so I wrote here and there. I had to learn how to write a book and how to kind of weave it all together. I had a class with a writer down in Atlanta, Tony Grooms, and he had given us exercises for producing and generating content, so that really helped. A semester of that really helped, and then it kind of came to be in the rewrites. Once I had pages, I was able to put them together and rewrite.
Did you have friends in Eastern Europe that you sent the manuscript to? I mean, did you vet the manuscript against people who are in the culture?
Well, my wife, I married a Hungarian woman, so my wife is Hungarian. So, but she didn't really read the book until it got published. So,
yeah, there's the whole trick of having a spouse be an editor, isn't there?
So, I just know, you know, she really didn't read that book until it got published. And
did your mother-in-law?
My mother-in-law didn't. No, they knew. People knew I was writing a book, but they said, oh, that's nice. But I just knew it. I'd spent like 5 years there, and and I remember saying, like, when I left to go travel, I said, the only way to do this is to really get inside the psyche of the place and the soul of the place. And I just felt like I'd somehow nailed the feeling of the place. And I was trying to even, like with the language, get that feel, tease the feeling out. And so I'm very pleased with it. And I think that I still visit. And when I go out to like the countryside, I drive around, I nailed it. I feel like I absolutely got the sense of place perfectly. The place is a setting in this book, I would say, in a very big way.
Now, after the book was published, you became the editor of the Chattahoochee Review?
Actually, that was long before that. That was one of the that was my job for a number of years. I edited the Chattahoochee Review, and it was easily 4 years, 4 or 5 years before the book was published. I was editing the Chattahoochee Review.
Talk to me a little bit about the different hat, the editor's hat.
That was that was learned as opposed to the impulse that drove me to write. So that was kind of a profession that I chose to pursue because I liked reading and writing, and I thought, well, I should go be an editor if I like reading and writing, which might, you know, in retrospect, seem like a ridiculous idea because, you know, the digital age came along and really changed everything. But at the time, I can say, like, I saw I was there for the last days of whatever. I don't know. That's not true. It was my learned profession, and I liked it. And how it affected my writing is that I think it gave me more control, and the idea that I should be more in control of the writing, as opposed to being more free-flowing and loose and just letting the writing pour out. So it's about marshaling the words and making them as precise as you can make them. So I really got that kind of benefit from having been an editor, I think.
And now I'm meeting you as a teacher. How does teaching affect your writing?
Oh, I've really been enjoying this experience.
Is this your first teaching experience?
It's not my first teaching experience. I've done conferences in Chattanooga and St. Petersburg, Florida, and in Atlanta. And I've done plenty of panels and talks. I preferred panels and talks because it was, I guess, just me talking and delivering it. And so for this project, for the Yale Writers Conference, I thought what I would do is actually come up with lectures or little brief introductions to different aspects of storytelling and narrative. And so that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun doing the research, and it was a lot of fun trying to get those ideas into easy to understand language and useful language and helpful language, and then to present it is always fun. I don't mind presenting it. So, and then it was great to hear the conversations that came about because people thought about the ideas. So that was a fun way to communicate and a fun way to engage people, and so I enjoyed it a lot.
Now, when we started talking, you mentioned that you have a book coming out this summer, and does that mean that you are not currently writing, that you've taken off the writer's hat now and will soon be putting on the commercial hat again?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, with the writer's hat or with the commercial hat, whichever you care to put on right now, tell us a little bit about the next book.
Well, the next book is a book called Elza's Kitchen. Elza is a chef. She, when the wall fell, she was a student. And so instead of having to take a state job, she decided to be an entrepreneur and open her own business. Her own restaurant, and she did, and she was successful at it. And this book is a look at 10 years after that point, so it takes you into the year maybe 2000, late 2000 probably. And what she has reached is the existential question that everybody reaches in the modern world, which is, what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? You know, she's done it long enough, she's been successful at it, and now she's just kind of wondering whether the passion is dying or whether she needs to rekindle it, and if so, how will she do that? And so it's really about the anxiety of being middle class, which is, you know, for them, a new situation. It's not one that they had before. And under communism, there wasn't a middle class. So you were a state worker, and then you retired. So
with the opening and with her able to be an entrepreneur, now she has the responsibility of that's really, I think, the theme of the whole project, is that your freedom is a responsibility. You have to do something with it.
With Valeria, you explored political changes, but you also explored those within the context of a woman of a certain age.
Right.
And it sounds very much like with Elsa, you are exploring political changes, but also changes for a woman of a certain economic group.
Yes.
Does age play a part here too? How old is Elsa?
She's also older. I do like older women, so Valeria is 68. My first heroine, she's 68. My next heroine is 48, because I'm also interested in seeing how these changes and how these eras that they live in affect. We can get an analyst, but as I'm getting older, the women are getting younger, so somewhere we're going to meet in the third book, we'll probably, I don't know, she'll be too young for me. Right now they're too old for me, and the third book she'll be too young for me, but I'm interested in seeing that development. I don't know why I went in descending order. It just felt right.
We'd really love it if you would share a little bit of Elsa with us.
Okay, so this is chapter one of Elsa's Kitchen, the first page. It was no mystery to Elsa that a great part of her distress in life came from the fact that so much of it was second rate. Never mind that at 48 and under carefully selected low-wattage bulbs, she was exceedingly comely. Never mind that when customers came to eat at a restaurant, they sought her out with no less than 8 men wanting to compliment her at any one time. She spoke back only out of politeness. She wasn't titillated in any fashion. That was never the issue. A potential romance with these men was not a danger. Quite simply, what Elsa found unsatisfying was the quality of the men who called on her. She was wary of them. She was wary of the lisping humanities professor and his incessant request for holiday thoth, wary of the postal inspector who smiled at her gamely whenever he sloped into the restaurant like some kind of pervert, wary most of all of the motorcycle officer who never removed his helmet, who sweated profusely at the armpits, and who always placed his sidearm on the table facing toward the other diners, as though he were the main character in a World War II era film, and these were the men worth mentioning. She was equally wary of the rest of them. She wished for a different 8 men, or was it really only 7? Thank God it was. 7 men and her friend, the elderly widow Eva, is what it really was. She wished for a different 7 men to want to speak with her. Sophisticated men, powerful men. Elsa would have preferred a judge to the professor with dribbled hollandaise sauce on his shirt front. She wanted a doctor instead of a bug-eyed postal pervert. And that these second-rate men were seemingly tethered to her did not help her ease her distress either. She knew it was entirely her fault for having encouraged them with smiles and coy banter, for having satisfied their appetites and filled their expanding bellies with her food. But this was the nature of her business. She was a chef, after all. She owned the restaurant, and opening a restaurant so soon after socialism's collapse had required her to be aggressively personable. In an era of runaway capitalism and millennial madness, she had to get along. It was not her fault that she understood the need for and perfected the skills of infectious enthusiasm and simulated empathy.
Do you cook?
Do I cook? I can cook, yes.
Did you have to learn any cooking?
I had to learn a lot of cooking for this, yeah. So there are... So one of the things I really try to do is add a sensual element to any book I'm writing, because I guess I'm a sensualist, I guess is what that was called. And I wanted to do something, though, that wasn't sexual. So I thought that a very sensual thing is food and cooking and the preparation of and the presentation of, and so that's why I chose to set it in a restaurant, and that's why I chose a chef, and so there are foods, traditional foods.
Traditional Hungarian foods
that are being written about, and I try to write about them as kind of as lyrically as possible in terms of the preparation of and presentation of, so that the reader, my goal really was that every page would kind of make the reader hungry. So that's...
So beware, you could gain weight reading Elsa's Kitchen. How do you spell Elsa?
E-L-Z-A.
Elsa's Kitchen.
Yes.
Okay. One last quick question. We're running out of time, but I am interested in whether or not, in fact, you are going to go for a younger woman. Have you got a third book planned?
I do have a third book planned, and I started the research on that. And
will it, too, be in Hungary?
It will be the last one, the last part of the trilogy. So it'll be a contemporary book. So it'll be today. It's been 20-something years since the Soviet Union collapsed and the Iron Curtain came down. We've had two generations pass, that older generation that existed, the middle-aged generation that was able to transition, and a generation that grew up the idea of communism as a memory. So it's not a part of their lives. They've grown up in a Western democratic system. The economy is shot everywhere. What do you do when you're young and ambitious and educated and you work at the opera house? It's going to be set in the capital at the opera house. A seamstress or a costume designer. That's pretty much what I've got as far as setting and character. And so I've been doing a lot of research on opera, and trying to figure out which opera will be the backdrop and what exactly will happen.
How long do you anticipate it will take you to...
About 2 years is what I anticipate.
So in two more years, we'll...
Maybe. I mean, you know, there's that saying, men plan, God laughs.
Right.
So we'll see what happens.
Well, we'll look forward to that. But first, we will look forward to Elsa's Kitchen. We've been talking with author Mark Fitton, author of Valeria's Last Stand, a novel. Thank you very much
for being with us. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.